Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, listeners. This episode is sponsored by iTalki. And although I really recommend their service for improving your English, I can't speak too loudly about it because I don't want to wake up my baby who is sleeping in the next room. So I'll whisper this sponsorship promo instead, okay? So the thing is that this podcast is designed to help you improve your English by listening to real English spoken by me, my friends, my family, and other people, okay? With my episodes, you can listen a lot on a regular basis for a long time, long term. And the cumulative effect of doing that is absolutely bound to be beneficial to your English. But you also need to speak to people in conversation in order to practice and develop those vital real-life communication skills. And now that's more possible than ever thanks to a platform like iTalki, which lets you connect with qualified teachers and native English speakers for lessons or just conversation practice. There are different prices available. It's all based on your needs and your timetable. And because you listen to this podcast, iTalki are offering you a free lesson. To get started, go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. And I've realised that me whispering like this sounds like I'm telling you a secret, doesn't it? And in a way, it is a little bit of a secret. Because people, just ordinary, normal, boring people who don't listen to this podcast, they might not know about this offer. So it's just between me and you, okay? It's just between me and you. All right, nice one. Okay, let's get started. And here's the jingle.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hello, folks. Welcome to this new episode of Luke's English Podcast. How are you doing out there in podcast land? I hope you're doing well today, wherever you are and whatever you happen to be doing at this moment. Here's a new episode, and this one is all about Professor Stephen Hawking. I hadn't been planning to do this episode. In fact, I woke up this morning to the news that Stephen Hawking had died. And I thought to myself, well, that's sad. And I really must talk about this on the podcast. So here it is. I'm doing it now in this episode. Unplanned, but I've kind of quickly put some things together. And I think this will be a whole episode all about Stephen Hawking. He was a British scientist who must be considered one of the most significant people of recent years. A brilliant mind who contributed so much to our understanding of the nature of reality itself, the universe, while also struggling against some extreme personal difficulties. And for those reasons, he continues to be, a great inspiration to many people around the world. And I think he's someone who's definitely worth talking about on this podcast. And so I'm just going to talk about Stephen Hawking, talk about his life and a few other things as well, okay? I don't know to what extent Stephen Hawking was known, respected, read in your countries. I think that Stephen Hawking's influence crosses many boundaries, international boundaries. I think he's known around the world as being a very significant person. I'm just going to read from his obituary. An obituary is like a summary of someone's life after they have died. Whenever someone dies, you can read the obituaries in the newspapers. And the one that I'm reading from here is on the BBC's website. So this is the BBC's obituary of Stephen Hawking. And this was published today. And it goes like this. So let me go through the obituary. I'm also going to talk about some other bits and pieces. And I will explain some language as we go. So this is a chance for us to just consider the life and work and influence and legacy of Professor Stephen Hawking, while also learning some English in the process. So Stephen Hawking, who died aged 76, battled motor neurone disease to become one of the world's most respected and best-known scientists. So motor neurone disease, this is a disease that affects the nerves and the brain. And it's pretty complicated, but essentially that deals with things like how much you can have control over your body. So obviously the brain is connected to the central nervous system. And through that central nervous system, the brain is able to control all the muscles in the body, which allow you to do everything, to move, to stand, to walk around, to communicate. And motor neurone disease left, well, it meant that Stephen Hawking basically could hardly move at all. I'll talk in more detail about it in a moment. So he battled motor neurone disease, and despite this serious health problem, he managed to become one of the most respected and best-known scientists of his age. Despite that problem, maybe even because of that problem, he said, I think, a couple of times that somehow having this disease sort of forced him to work in a certain way. That may have encouraged him to focus his obviously amazing mind on theoretical physics. And since he couldn't actually do the physical part of scientific experiments and lecturing and things like that, it meant that he had to focus his mind entirely on theories of physics. And that's where he, I guess, made the most progress, or that's where he achieved so much. And maybe, in a weird way, not being able to move meant that he was able to focus his mind a lot more on theoretical work. The obituary continues like this. It says, a man of great humour, he became a popular ambassador for science and was always careful to ensure that the general public had ready access to his work. His book, A Brief History of Time, became an unlikely bestseller, although it's unclear how many people actually managed to get to the end of it. A Brief History of Time is a very, very successful book in the sense that it was bought by lots of people, although we don't know how many of those people actually read it or finished it. I mean, he's famous for bringing very complicated theories about physics into the popular domain, and the book was written to be read by the layman or lay people. Lay people, that's a word to describe people who don't have specific expert scientific knowledge, okay? And it works for science. So if you're not a scientist, you're a lay person. Like me, I'm a lay person, someone who doesn't have all of the expert knowledge of science, and I don't know all the complicated language and ideas in science. So I'm just like a normal person, or a non-scientifically educated person, a lay person. It works in law as well. If you get a trained lawyer or someone who knows all about the language of law, then that's a legal person or something, a lawyer. But if you're not a lawyer, if you've never done any legal training, you don't know all the language of law and all the complex legal terms, then you're a lay person as well, a layman. So the book was successful as a way of bringing complicated theories of physics to the lay person. Although I think the book was incredibly complicated and not that many people actually finished it. If you remember, last year I did an episode of this podcast all about the stand-up comedian Bill Bailey, and we listened to a bit of his routine about Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. And basically, Bill Bailey was saying that he chose to read the book, but it was so, even the title was a bit too complicated for him. Here's a quick reminder. If you want to hear more of this, you can go back and listen to the episode about Bill Bailey. But here's a quick reminder of what one of the things Bill Bailey, the comedian, said about A Brief History of Time.
I'm always trying to better myself. Brief History of Time, right. How can time have a history? Surely history is time, isn't it? And time is history, and time is an unbroken chain stretching off into the future, back into the past. And how can such a thing be brief if it is infinite? And I thought to myself, I can't even get past the title.
All right. So how can if time be brief if it's infinite? And how can you have a brief history? Because a brief history of time, surely time is history and history is time. And time is just infinite. So how can you have a brief history of time? And I thought to myself, I can't even get past the title, which I imagine is what the book is like. I haven't read it, but I imagine that it's hard to even progress past the first page. It's probably so dense and so complicated. Anyway, it's a famous book, a best-selling book, but I wonder how many people have actually read it. Stephen Hawking was famous, as it said in the obituary there, he was famous for having a good sense of humour, which I think is evident in certain things that he did in his life. For example, he appeared in episodes of The Simpsons, and also he was interviewed by John Oliver on his show, and that was a very funny moment. So it's good to know that someone like this had such a good sense of humour. That's always an attractive aspect of a person's personality. It always, not just for me, but generally people find that so endearing when a brilliant man like this has a sense of humour, because you could imagine that, you know, a genius, a professor of this calibre, you can imagine him being a very self-important, pompous, arrogant kind of person. You'd probably let him get away with it because you think, well, he is Stephen Hawking, he's a genius. But apparently Stephen Hawking was able to laugh at himself and he had a good sense of humour too. We might explore that side of his personality later on in this episode. Let's carry on with the obituary. Stephen Hawking appeared in a number of popular TV shows, like The Simpsons, and lent his synthesised voice to various recordings. That's right, he had a synthesised voice. So because of his motor neurone disease, he actually lost the control of all of the muscles and all of the different physical parts of the body responsible for producing speech. And so his voice was replaced by a synthesized voice, which is incredible. I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but he essentially would work. I don't really know, but he would be in a wheelchair. The wheelchair had a computer attached to it. And the computer was incredibly sophisticated, and it was able to. So I think the only part of his face that he could move was like a muscle in his cheek, and he was fitted with a special pair of glasses, I think, which had a sensor on them, so that he could move his cheek and control the computer, and the computer itself had like a voice box, like a synthesized voice and software that allowed him to type sentences, or maybe choose from phrases, you know, that he frequently used, you know, like a bit like when you write a text message on your iPhone and it predicts the words you're going to use, or it's got like a bank of phrases that, you know, it expects you might need to use. And so you can kind of produce your texts much more quickly. I think Stephen Hawking was using a similar system like quite early on, like before we had that kind of thing in our phones. Anyway, so he would communicate using a computer, read, which he controlled with somehow using the muscle in his cheek, using a sensor connecting to the computer, and that's how he produced his speech. And it was so he had this characteristic synthesized voice, was famous. You know, Stephen Hawking was famous for speaking in that synthesized sort of robotic sounding voice. Stephen William Hawking was born in Oxford on the 8th of January 1942. His father, a research biologist, had moved with his mother from London to escape German bombing. So they moved away from London in order to escape the German bombing in the war. He was born during the war, part of that generation that was born during or just after the war. I guess he was a contemporary of people like the Beatles. Stephen Hawking grew up in London and St Albans, and after gaining a first-class degree in physics from Oxford, went on to Cambridge for postgraduate research in cosmology. As a teenager, he had enjoyed horse riding and rowing, but while at Cambridge, he was diagnosed with a form of motor neurone disease, which was to leave him almost completely paralysed. Paralysed basically means that you can't move. If you're paralysed, it means you can't move, right? Often people become paralysed after they have an accident that damages the spine. So if you break your back, for example, you can be paralysed from the waist down or paralysed from the neck down. I mean, famously, Christopher Reeve, the actor who used to play Superman, fell off a horse, and I think he damaged his spine in his neck, and he was paralysed from the neck down. In the case of Stephen Hawking, he was paralysed by the motor neurone disease, which basically attacked the central nervous system, leaving him almost completely paralysed. As he was preparing to marry his first wife, Jane, in 1964, his doctors gave him no more than 2 or 3 years of life. So back in 1964, doctors predicted that he would only live for a couple of years. But the disease progressed more slowly than expected, luckily. The couple had 3 children, and in 1988, although Hawking was by now only able to speak with a voice synthesizer following a tracheotomy, he had completed A Brief History of Time, a layman's guide to cosmology. So he had a tracheotomy, which is basically when the windpipe, so the windpipe is the part of your throat where air passes between the lungs and the mouth. That's your windpipe. It's in your throat. A tracheotomy is when the windpipe is they basically cut into the windpipe in order to allow you to breathe. So it's probably, I guess the windpipe is hooked up maybe to a computer or a machine or something that does the job how to explain it. Normally, if your central nervous system works properly, there are lots of functions in your body which are done by the brain without you having to think about it. The brain just sends these messages to your body, for example, to make you breathe. So you breathe without thinking about it. It's automatic. But if your nervous system, if all the neurons aren't working properly, then it might be the case that you don't breathe, or your body doesn't breathe. I don't know to what extent Stephen Hawking could actually breathe on his own. Anyway, he must have had various types of work done to allow him to breathe, and perhaps his windpipe was probably, you know, because he couldn't hold himself up physically, because he, you know, lacking the muscle power, the motor skills to be able to actually hold himself up physically. I expect his windpipe got a bit squashed or crushed or something. Anyway, they had to perform a tracheotomy on him, which I suppose caused him to lose his voice. I mean, even if he had been able to control his mouth and do all the things that we can do in order to speak, maybe he wouldn't have been able to do that anyway because they performed this tracheotomy. Let's go back to the obituary. So the disease progressed more slowly. Fine. So the book, A Brief History of Time, sold more than 10 million copies, although its author was aware that it was dubbed the most popular book never read. So again, evidence there that probably lots of people bought it, but not that many people actually read it because it's so bloody difficult. Not the sort of book you can take with you on holiday. He received honorary degrees, medals, prizes, and awards throughout his career, and was honoured with a CBE in 1982. CBE is one of the classes of honour which is given to people by the Queen. There are different levels or different classes. We have MBE, OBE, CBE, KBE or DBE, and GBE. To be honest, the ones that most of us know are MBE, OBE, CBE, and the Knighthood. Okay, and so MBE is the member of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. OBE is Officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. CBE is Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. And then above that, it's the Knighthood or Damehood. And that's when you become Sir, for example, Sir Paul McCartney, or Dame, like Dame Judi Dench. These are basically honours which are given to people by the Queen as a way of saying, well done, you're brilliant, you contributed a lot to Britain in some way. So anyway, it's a very distinguished thing to receive, the CBE. So he was honoured with a CBE in 1982. I think he may have been offered the Knighthood, but it was later revealed that he turned it down over issues with the government's funding for science. So this is a man of principle. He was offered the Knighthood. He could have been Sir Stephen Hawking, but he turned it down because he disagreed with the way in which the government was funding scientific programs. So clearly he cared a lot more about science than he did about his own personal celebrity. On the subject of celebrity, Hawking discovered the phenomenon which became known as Hawking radiation, where black holes leak energy and fade to nothing. Hawking radiation. Well, this is where black holes leak energy and fade to nothing. All right. He was renowned for his extraordinary capacity to visualize scientific solutions without calculation or experiment. This is maybe one of the most amazing things about Stephen Hawking, right? Now, he came up with incredible theories about things like the way that black holes work and sort of quantum level science. It really, really complicated and difficult stuff. And what's amazing is that he did it all just in his head. He wasn't kind of writing it all down. He wasn't there kind of at the blackboard with a piece of chalk, you know, writing out all of these equations and things like that, like you see in the movies. Or even like most scientists or most theoretical physicists, I imagine, are sort of writing things down at least, you know. But he just did it all in his head, just all abstract thinking, which is an incredible thing to be able to do. I mean, the capacity of the guy's brain to be able to hold all of that stuff all at the same time. Amazing. Incredibly intelligent. But it was perhaps his theory of everything, suggesting that the universe evolves according to well-defined laws, that attracted most attention. This complete set of laws can give us the answers to questions like, how did the universe begin? He said. Where is it going? And will it have an end? If so, how will it end? If we find the answers to these questions, we really shall know the mind of God. Wow, that's what he said about the theory of everything. Hawking's celebrity status was acknowledged even by The Simpsons. He was depicted drinking at a bar with Homer, suggesting that he might steal Homer's idea that the universe is shaped like a donut. He appeared in a special documentary about BBC comedy series Red Dwarf, during which he spoke about why he enjoyed the show, and also starred in Star Trek The Next Generation as a hologram of his image. So Stephen Hawking apparently was a fan of Red Dwarf, which is a British comedy series that I think I mentioned in my recent episode about British TV comedy shows. So, you know, if it's good enough for Stephen Hawking, it's good enough for us, isn't it? Red Dwarf, you might want to check it out. Maybe I should do an episode about it at some point. It was a really funny science fiction sitcom about a bunch of people kind of stuck in space, and there were lots of different... The show was quite knowledgeable about science and about physics and things like that, so there were lots of sort of jokes about time travel and black holes and that kind of thing. The rock group Pink Floyd used Stephen Hawking's distinctive synthesized voice for the introduction to one of their songs, Keep Talking, on their 1994 album, The Division Bell. And undeterred by his condition, if you're undeterred by something, it means that you're not deterred by it. If you're deterred, it means you're like put off or prevented from doing something. Or maybe if you're deterred, it means you decide not to do something because maybe you're scared about it. For example, what's a good example? If someone says to you, hey, let's go to this nightclub, and you heard a report that nightclub was a bit dangerous, that someone like got shot there or something, you would be deterred by the report. By the news, you see. But anyway, in this story, the word is used like this. Undeterred by his condition, he continued his work as a Lucasian professor of mathematics at Cambridge University. And in 2001, his second book, Universe in a Nutshell, was published. You know the expression, in a nutshell. If you say something or describe something in a nutshell, it's like you kind of summarize it in a very brief way. Okay, nice title, Universe in a Nutshell. I think it also relates to his ideas about the singularity, which is, I think, a concept he came up with in order to explain what happens at the heart of a black hole. A black hole is, it's difficult to explain, isn't it? It's, I guess, what happens when a star dies eventually, because eventually what happens is the star implodes on itself. And if all of that mass that used to make up the star starts to form a very small space, like a hole, the hole is so dense, you know, like the way planets are very dense and they have a lot of mass and they attract other things towards them because of gravity. Well, a black hole is so dense that it sucks everything into it. Everything's flying in towards it. And apparently this gets so intense, this suction of things into this void in the middle, gets so intense that in the middle there is like infinite gravity where everything gets kind of squished into one single tiny spot. And that tiny spot is known as a singularity, which when it, I guess, reaches some state, it then explodes, spewing out massive amounts of energy. Many people understand that this is how the universe began. It began from a singularity of like all matter squeezed into almost unimaginably small space, which is so incredibly dense. And it's like imploding on itself until one point, poof, it explodes out. And that's the beginning of the Big Bang. That is the Big Bang. And that's the beginning of the universe. So the universe in a nutshell, you know, you can understand that in this tiny little space, in a nutshell, that the whole universe packed inside it, this kind of relates to his theory of the singularity. I don't really understand all of it. As I've said, I'm a lay person. But anyway, it's certainly interesting. Erratic. This is going back to the obituary. One of the subtitles in the obituary. Obituary, that's how you say it. I know that word, it does have the word bitch in it. Obituary, yeah, okay. Anyway, in the obituary, the word erratic is here as a subtitle. Erratic basically means like unpredictable or inconsistent, okay? So talking about his inconsistency in his life, erratic. So it says, he believed his illness brought some benefits. He said before he developed the disease, he'd been bored with life. So his life was kind of like up and down or erratic or inconsistent. There was like a period before the disease developed that he said he was bored with life. Interesting. But his condition inevitably made him dependent on others. Actually, going back to that idea of him being bored with life before he got sick, obviously it must have been awful to have motor neurone disease and to lose all that control in your body and to be stuck in a wheelchair and to only be able to communicate through a computer like that and to have all those operations and all that, to be in hospital so much and so on. It must be awful. But it seemed that Stephen Hawking was the kind of person to try to look on the positive side of things And that one of the things that's inspirational about him is that even with adversity like that, he managed to somehow make it all work to his advantage. Adversity, challenge, or difficulty can somehow focus you and force you to concentrate your energy in one direction. It must have been tough, but it's almost like he thrived on the adversity or something. Yes, but his condition inevitably made him dependent on others. He often paid tribute to his wife, who had looked after him for more than 20 years, and friends and relatives were shocked when he left her for one of his nurses, Elaine Mason, whom he married in 1995. The couple later divorced in 2006. By 2000, Hawking was a frequent visitor to the emergency department of Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, seeking treatment for a variety of injuries. Police questioned several people about allegations that he had been subjected to verbal and physical abuse over a period of years. So there were maybe some suggestions that he was being abused, but he was known to be an erratic, almost reckless driver of his electric wheelchair, and Hawking insisted his injuries were not caused by abuse, so no action was taken. So, yeah, there were sort of suggestions or allegations that he'd been abused. I don't know by who, by people caring for him, but he always said that he wasn't being abused, and in fact that he was just a bad driver of his electric wheelchair. So no action was taken in there. I wonder about his personal life. I remember my brother used to live in Cambridge, and he saw Stephen Hawking a couple of times, and apparently he was always accompanied by a woman, a nurse, or maybe his girlfriend or his wife or something like that. But James just always noticed that Stephen Hawking, there was always a woman with him. And that, I mean, it seems that he was a bit of a ladies' man, funnily enough. So in 2007, he became the first quadriplegic to experience weightlessness on board the so-called Vomit Comet, a modified plane specially designed to simulate zero gravity. They called it the Vomit Comet. What a lovely name. I imagine they called it that because, well, a comet, you know, is a thing that sort of flies through space, like an asteroid. But a vomit comet, yeah, I suppose they called it that because when people ride on it, they throw up. Anyway, lovely name, the Vomit Comet. But he was the first quadriplegic. A quadriplegic is someone who's affected by paralysis of all four limbs. So basically, someone whose arms and legs are paralyzed. And that's a quadriplegic. So he was the first quadriplegic ever to spend time in zero gravity. And there's actually video of him sort of floating in zero gravity with a big smile on his face. He said that he did it to encourage interest in space travel. And he booked a seat on Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic suborbital space plane. He said, "I believe that life on Earth is at an ever-increasing risk of being wiped out by a disaster such as sudden nuclear war, a genetically engineered virus, or other dangers." So, an ever-increasing risk of being wiped out. If you are wiped out, or if something is wiped out, it means it's removed from existence. So that's a bit worrying, I have to say, a bit scary that such an intelligent man, maybe one of the most intelligent men on the planet, had genuine fears of the human race being wiped out by a nuclear war or some genetically engineered virus, like a weaponized virus or something like that. Bit scary. He said, "I think the human race has I think the human race has no future if it doesn't go into space. I therefore want to encourage public interest in space." So, a believer in space travel. In 2014, the film The Theory of Everything was released, based on Jane Hawking's account of their courtship and marriage. Hawking himself met Eddie Redmayne as part of the actor's preparation for taking on the role of the scientist. In a series for the Discovery Channel, he said it was perfectly rational to assume that there was intelligent life elsewhere, but he warned that aliens might just raid Earth of its resources and then move on. So, yeah, not out of the question that aliens exist. But the scary thing is that he thought that if aliens did exist, that they might not be nice. They might just want to raid Earth of all of its resources, which actually, when you think about it, could be quite possible when you consider the fact that from Earth, we've been searching for planets with life or stuff that could help sustain life, like, you know, resources, minerals, energy. And we haven't really found anything yet. I mean, maybe we're not that sophisticated at looking for things, that we're not very good at space travel yet. We don't know. But the universe itself might be a rather desolate place. It might be, you know, like a huge desert in a sense. And the Earth is like an oasis in that desert. And so if there were aliens out there that were sophisticated enough to travel around, they might see the Earth and they might just see things like all of our water and things like oil and coal and stuff. And they might just think, well, we don't care about these stupid humans, you know, and their social media and football and corruption and stuff like that. They've got water and oil and oxygen. We'll have all that, thanks very much. So it could be like something out of a science fiction film. Anyway, Hawking also predicted the end of humanity from global warming, a large comet, or a new virus. Lovely. He also collaborated with Russian investor Yuri Milner in 2015 to work on projects to find evidence of alien life. He once wrote that he had motor neurone disease for practically all his adult life, but said that it had not stopped him from having an attractive family and being successful in his work. It shows, he said, that one need not lose hope. That's a nice positive message there, even if you know, the human race might get wiped out by global warming or an asteroid or by viruses or something. That I guess we shouldn't worry about that stuff too much. And on a more positive note, if you've got difficulty in your life, we must remember that where there is life, there is hope. And so there's always a chance, even when it looks pretty bleak, when things look a bit hopeless, like, for example, when you get paralyzed from the neck down, for example, that it's not the end of the world, that there's still potential for a rich and satisfying life ahead of you. And that's a rather wonderful, beautiful idea, isn't it? Yes, it is. Stephen Hawking apparently was also very popular in China. Now, he was popular and inspirational all over the world, I'm sure. And you can write in the comments section of this episode how Stephen Hawking is known in your country. But according to a BBC News report, he was particularly loved and respected in China. So this is I'm just going to read a bit from this report by Tessa Wong on the BBC News website. And it said, Stephen Hawking, China's love for the late physicist. The late physicist. That's an interesting phrase. We do that. We say that to mean that someone is dead. For example, the late Stephen Hawking. And that just means that it's just a way of referring to someone being dead. Now, it's weird, isn't it, that we say that? The late Stephen Hawking, the late Professor Stephen Hawking. You know, why are we saying that? He's not late. You know, it's not like he's on his way. He's not coming at all. He's dead. But anyway, we do say the late physicist or the late Stephen Hawking, meaning someone who's dead. As the world mourns Professor Stephen Hawking, who has died aged 76, there has been a particular outpouring of emotion in China, where the visionary physicist was revered, meaning highly respected, by scientists, students, the state, and even boy band stars, so like pop stars. He will roam across the universe and its galaxies, and in the end will again become its brightest star, said one commenter on the Chinese microblogging network Weibo. Another person said, he belongs to the stars and has returned home now. Many people in China grew up reading Professor Hawking's seminal book, A Brief History of Time, Apparently, the circulation of the Chinese language edition is reportedly second only to that of the English circulation. So the book sold most copies in English, but the second... So the book sold most of its copies in English, but also a lot of copies in Chinese as well. His 2006 visit to China was covered with breathless excitement. Huh! With state media comparing his appeal to that of Tom Cruise. And when he joined Weibo in 2016, saying hello to my friends in China, he was met with a rapturous response, amassing millions of followers within hours. Professor Hawking was, of course, beloved around the world, but the adulation and respect he's always commanded in China is perhaps in another universe altogether. Scholars and academics have traditionally been held in high regard in Chinese culture, which also prizes a hard, striving and disciplined work ethic. Having overcome great odds in his life, he was seen as having these qualities in spades. There's a nice expression. To have something in spades, it means that you've got a lot of it. For example, the Chinese revere a hard, striving and disciplined work ethic. So he has, and Stephen Hawking has these qualities in spades. He's very hardworking. He's got a very strong, he had a very strong work ethic. So he had those qualities in spades. A spade, by the way, is a tool that you would use to dig in the ground. So if you want to shift a lot of earth, if you've dug a hole in the ground and you need to shift a lot of that earth, you'd use a spade or a shovel. It's like a digging tool. So if you have something in spades, it means you have a lot of it. Okay. We all admire his creativity and his spirit of research, despite the extreme difficulty of his physical situation. Tsinghua University Professor Xing Tung Yao told the BBC. I'm sure I pronounced that correctly, didn't I? Of course I did. Professor Yao, who helped to arrange Professor Hawking's visits to China, added, he was very friendly and was willing to explain physics to laymen. His smile attracted the attention of everybody. The Chinese are grateful for his generosity in spending time in China. Professor Hawking also came along at a time when modern China began accelerating its scientific and space ambitions. Thus, a role model ideal for the Chinese state to champion emerged. A role model ideal for the Chinese state to champion emerged. To champion, that means to celebrate, support, to, let's say, for example, if you often hear this expression, to champion something, you often hear it on BBC's music radio station, BBC Six Music. And that's because often what they do is they champion new bands or new artists. I guess probably a band like the Arctic Monkeys, when they first arrived on the scene, they were championed by BBC Six Music, meaning BBC Six Music found the Arctic Monkeys before other people had, and they played their records a lot on the radio, and they generally sort of supported and promoted them. They turned them into champions, you know, they championed them. So to champion something. Yeah. Okay. Because Hawking came along when China was accelerating its scientific and space ambitions, he represented a kind of a role model which was ideal for the Chinese state to champion. So China championed him as a role model, especially because of the adversity. You know, hard work in adverse conditions. That is something to champion, I would say. Hawking has near superstar status in China, and the Chinese government preaches that scientific prowess is crucial to the country's future power. Prowess is like skill or expertise in a particular activity or field. So like brilliance, excellence. That's prowess. So Hawking has near superstar status in China, and the Chinese government preaches that scientific prowess is crucial to the country's future power, reads one report carried by state media in 2006. It also helped that he was generally not critical of China at first. Does that mean that later he was critical of China? I don't know. Anyway, he wasn't critical of China. That probably helped. And he was happy to play to the crowd. If you play to the crowd, it means you kind of please the crowd. For example, this is something that he said. He said, "I like Chinese culture, Chinese food, and above all, Chinese women." I told you he was a ladies' man. He said, I like Chinese culture, Chinese food, and above all, Chinese women. They're beautiful, he told his audience at an appearance during his last trip, while also praising the Chinese for being very clever, hardworking, and having achieved a lot in science and technology. Don't worry, other countries, if you're now feeling jealous that Stephen Hawking was so positive about China, if you're in another country and you're thinking, oh, I want him to say nice things about my country too, I'm sure that he, being the benevolent and lovely man that he was, I'm sure he would have had lovely things to say about many countries. Okay, if at this point you're feeling a little bit unloved compared to the love flying in the direction of China at this point. Now, Stephen Hawking, as well as contributing so much to our understanding of the universe, he also was an inspiration to people struggling against difficulty of various kinds, both physical and mental. And I found an interesting article on a website called The Mind's Journal. What's The Mind's Journal? What's all that about? The Mind's Journal is a platform that brings together writers and readers from across the world to share thoughts that promote self-development. Okay, so it's all about self-development, which often self-development, you know, that could be about things like trying to become a better person or self-motivation and things like that. And this article by Zanim on The Mind's Journal is entitled, "Stephen Hawking has a beautiful message for anyone suffering from depression." I think that depression is something that all of us experience at one time or another, some people more than other people. But depression is something that can strike any of us, even if you don't even realize, if it's not being labeled as depression, if you just feel like things are a little bit too difficult, or if you just feel like you don't have everything under control, or you feel like giving up, or whatever. You know those feelings. We all feel like that from time to time. Apparently, Stephen Hawking said some things that could be comforting to anyone suffering from those feelings. And it on this website, these things are written. After his diagnosis, Hawking said that he had absolutely no expectations for life, but he didn't let it deter him from doing his best to live fully and passionately. There's that word deter again. Deter from doing. You notice, deter someone from doing something. So his diagnosis of his motor neurone disease, he didn't let that deter him from doing his best to live fully and passionately. He has 12 honorary degrees and has built a life dedicated to the study of theoretical physics, including robust theories on creation, the Big Bang, and the universe. By the way, this is written in the present tense, this article, because it was written when Stephen Hawking was still alive. Depression is a subject that Stephen Hawking recently commented on at a lecture in London at the Royal Institute, likening the condition to a black hole. Likening, meaning comparing it or saying that it was similar. So he likened depression to a black hole. He said, "The message of this lecture is that black holes aren't as black as they are painted. They're not the eternal prisons that they were once thought." So I think this is relating to one of his theories about black holes, is that they, I guess what people used to think is that when matter went into a black hole, it was lost forever. But I think Stephen Hawking suggested that when matter goes into a black hole, it doesn't stay there forever, that it can actually come out or go out the other side. And there are theories even that black holes represent portals to alternative universes, parallel realities. I don't know. It's amazing. I don't really understand it all. But the point is that Stephen Hawking suggested that black holes weren't like prisons. So when matter, when stuff goes into a black hole, it is possible for it to escape or go out the other side or something. He said, things can get out of a black hole, both on the outside and possibly to another universe. So if you feel that you're in a black hole, don't give up. There is a way out. Which is a nice way of reminding us that there is always hope, that we should never give up. Furthermore, when asked about his disabilities and the effect that they have on his outlook on life, he responded beautifully. He said, the victim should have the right to end his life if he wants. But I think that it would be a great mistake. However bad life may seem, there's always something that you can do and succeed at. While there's life, there is hope. That's a good sentiment, don't you think? That even when things look really, really bad, that there's always something, there is always hope there. As long as you're still alive, there is always the potential and possibility for you to come out of the darkness and ultimately succeed. He would further this sentiment with a heartfelt message for those with disabilities like himself. And by the way, disabled is the word that we use to describe people who've got like physical disabilities. Like, you know, for example, someone who's in a wheelchair, we say disabled. OK, we don't say handicapped as the word for people with a disability. We'd say disabled people. He said, if you're disabled, it's probably not your fault, but it's no good blaming the world or expecting it to take pity on you. One has to have a positive attitude and must make the best of the situation that one finds oneself in. Notice that he's using the word one, meaning, you know, people in general. Often we just say you these days, but one is the slightly perhaps old-fashioned or proper way of saying it. One has to have a positive attitude and must make the best of the situation that one finds oneself in. If one is physically disabled, one cannot afford to be psychologically disabled as well. In my opinion, one should concentrate on activities in which one's physical disability will not present a serious handicap. Here, the word handicap is used to refer to an obstacle that will prevent you from doing something. It's not the word used to describe the people. We use disabled for the people. A handicap in this case would be a barrier or an obstacle. He said, I'm afraid that Olympic Games for the disabled don't appeal to me, but it's easy for me to say that because I never liked athletics anyway. On the other hand, science is a very good area for disabled people because it goes on mainly in the mind. Of course, most kinds of experimental work are probably ruled out for most such people, but theoretical work is almost ideal. My disabilities have not been a significant handicap in my field, which is theoretical physics. Indeed, they've helped me in a way by shielding me from lecturing and administrative work that I would otherwise have been involved in. I've managed, however, only because of the large amount of help that I've received from my wife, children, colleagues, and students. I find that people in general are very ready to help, but you should encourage them to feel that their efforts to aid you are worthwhile by doing as well as you possibly can. That's nice, isn't it? He sounded like a nice bloke, didn't he, Stephen Hawking? Positive, sort of a hopeful, positive person, and someone who felt it was important to let people know their value and how helpful and useful other people can be. And also, it was nice to know that he's the kind of person who recognized the fact that these, you know, achievements are often a group effort, that you need to recognize the other people in your life who've helped you achieve things. That's nice, isn't it? Very nice. I'm going to play you a quick scene from the film The Theory of Everything, which is on YouTube, and this is a scene with Eddie Redmayne portraying Stephen Hawking, although we don't hear Eddie's voice, of course, because in this scene Stephen Hawking is communicating using the synthesized voice. So you'll hear Stephen Hawking's characteristic voice in this clip. But he's in a big lecture theater with a big audience, and someone asks him a question about God.
Professor Hawking, you have said you do not believe in God. Do you have a philosophy of life?
Well, that's weird. The sound is not very good. Did you hear that?
Professor Hawking, you have said you do not believe in God.
Professor Hawking, you have said that you do not believe in God.
Do you have a philosophy of life that helps you?
Do you have a philosophy of life that helps you? Okay. Now, in the movie scene, it's no good to you here in audio, but one of the girls in the audience drops her pen on the ground, and Stephen Hawking kind of imagines being able to get up, bend down and pick up the pen for this attractive girl and then hand it back to her. He sort of has a little daydream, and then he manages to answer the question. We go back to reality, and he answers the question about whether or not he has a philosophy about life, considering he doesn't believe in God.
You have said you do not believe in God. Do you have a philosophy of life that helps you?
It is clear that we are just an advanced breed of primates.
It's clear that we're just an advanced breed of primates. Okay.
It is clear that we are just an advanced breed of primates on a minor planet orbiting around a very average star.
We're just an advanced breed of primates
on a minor
planet orbiting around a very average star.
Your planet orbiting around a very average star in the outer suburb of one among 100 billion galaxies.
In the outer suburb of one among 100 billion galaxies. So basically saying that we're very insignificant, just in some tiny corner of the universe, just an advanced species of primates.
But ever since the dawn of civilization.
But ever since the dawn of civilization,
people have craved for an understanding of the underlying order of the world.
People have craved for an understanding of the underlying order of the world.
There ought to be something very special about the boundary conditions of the universe.
There ought to be something very special about the boundary conditions of the universe. So there must be something very special about the boundary or the edge, the frontier of the universe. What is the limit of the universe? This is a question that people have often asked themselves.
And what can be more special than that there is no boundary?
And what can be more special than the fact that there is no boundary?
There should be no boundary to human endeavor.
And there should be no boundary to human endeavor.
We are all different, however bad life may seem.
We're all different, and however bad life may seem,
there is always something you can do and succeed at.
No matter how difficult life may seem, there's always something that we can do and succeed at.
There is life. There is hope.
And the audience gives him a standing ovation, rising to their feet to applaud him. Where there's life, there's hope. I think it's a good sentiment, don't you? So I mentioned before about the fact that Stephen Hawking is known for having his sense of humour. He was interviewed by John Oliver on John Oliver's show Last Week Tonight. You may have seen this. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but they did a series on Last Week Tonight, which is kind of like a sort of satire comedy show where they talk about news and things. And they did a series called Great Minds. And in this one, they talked to, well, John Oliver talked to Stephen Hawking. And John Oliver is brilliant. He's a very funny comedian. from the UK who now is based in the United States, and he does sort of political satire on his show. Very funny guy. And this is him talking to Stephen Hawking. And it just shows that Stephen Hawking's obviously got a sense of humour if he was willing to go along with this interview and the general sort of funny questions that John Oliver is asking him.
I travel to the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge University to speak with one of the world's greatest living minds.
First off, congratulations on being the first subject of our Great Mind series. Be honest, is this the single greatest honour you have ever received?
Yes.
Good. It's a little hard to read your tone of voice. When you say that, are you being sarcastic?
Yes.
I thought so.
It's so great actually seeing that because obviously that's very funny. So, you know, congratulations, this must be the single greatest honour of your life to be featured in this interview, being the first guest in our Great Minds series. You know, does that feel like the greatest honour you've ever experienced? And he says, yes. And, well, you heard it. I'm repeating it maybe just to help those people who didn't catch it. But and he said, it's hard to tell by the tone of your voice if you're being sarcastic or not. Are you being sarcastic? And he said, yes. And then there's like this wonderful smile on Stephen Hawking's face, which shows that he's clearly enjoying this funny conversation. Wonderful.
Say that, are you being sarcastic?
Yes.
I thought so. If there is one thing you want people to understand about your work, bearing in mind that most people will never understand anything about your work, what would that thing be?
Imaginary time. People think it's something you have in dreams, or when you're up against a deadline. But it's a well-defined concept. Imaginary time is like another direction in space. It's the one bit of my work science fiction writers haven't used, because they don't understand it.
Imaginary time? I'm not sure I understand that either, but maybe that's the feeling that sometimes time feels like it's going more slowly, and sometimes it feels like it's going very quickly. Like, for example, when you are waiting for a bus, it feels like time goes really, really slowly. Or when you're listening to Luke's English podcast, it feels like time... Well, does it feel like time goes very slowly or very quickly? I don't know. But anyway, it just at certain different times in your life, it feels like time moves more quickly or more slowly. Like when you're really enjoying something, it feels like time flies. Whereas when you're kind of experiencing something a bit boring, then it feels like time goes really, really, really slowly. Like, you know, if you've got a job, like a really shit job at McDonald's or something, and you have to do an 8-hour shift, I mean, that 8 hours can feel like an absolute lifetime, especially if you keep looking at your watch, which you shouldn't do, by the way. You know, if you're trying to make time go more quickly, don't keep looking at your watch because you'll just be more and more aware of the passing of time. So you should just completely ignore your watch and try and forget about time completely, and then it'll probably pass more quickly. Maybe that's what he's talking about with imaginary time, that sense that sometimes time feels like it's going faster or slower. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But anyway, he's saying that this is the thing that science fiction writers, the one idea that science fiction writers haven't stolen from him because they don't understand it. It could be a good idea though, couldn't it? Imaginary time, that being able to slow down or speed up time based on the experience you're having, that could be like an interesting idea. Maybe you could get Arnold Schwarzenegger, who manages to slow downtime by doing something very boring. What could it be? Maybe like there's he's got to chase a serial killer, and in order to prevent the serial killer from being able to commit the crime, he reads a grammar book. Ah, present perfect. Ah, and that slows down time. And then he manages to catch the killer. Or maybe he leaves like pages from a grammar book on the floor. I don't know. It's just a stupid idea. Anyway, that's what science fiction writers haven't used yet because they don't understand it. I don't understand it either. But it could be a good vehicle for an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, don't you think?
imaginary time.
Congratulations on being the first subject of our Great Mind series. Be honest, is this the single greatest honour you have ever received?
Yes.
Good. It's a little hard to read your tone of voice. When you say that, are you being sarcastic?
Yes.
I thought so. If there is one thing you want people to understand about your work, bearing in mind that most people will never understand anything about your work, what would that thing be?
Imaginary time. People think it's something you have in dreams, or when you're up against a deadline. But it's a well-defined concept. Imaginary time is like another direction in space. It's the one bit of my work science fiction writers haven't used, because they don't understand it.
Ugh, idiots. People are such idiots, because presumably, to my mind, you're simply talking about the theoretical measurement obtained from real time by a wink rotation of pi divided by 2 in the complex plane where t equals I times t. It's just not that difficult to get your head around.
Obviously being ironic there, because he's pretending like he knows what imaginary time is. Ha ha ha, very funny. Anyway, you can watch the rest of that clip on the internet. You've heard of the internet, right? Of course you have. All right, I'll put that video on the page for this episode. How about that? Yeah, that would be great, Luke. Thanks. That's what you're all saying.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks so much.
That's like a massive audience of people around the world. All thanking me for putting that video on the page for this episode, just to make your life so much better. Ah, oh. All right. Now, I thought I'd end this episode with a song, and this is a song written by Eric Idle, who was a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, that comedy group from the UK in the 70s and 60s and stuff, still going today, more or less. So this is a song written by Eric Idle, which was used in the Monty Python film The Meaning of Life. And it's a song called the Galaxy Song, and it's all about the galaxy, about the universe and stuff. And I want to do this one because apparently Stephen Hawking agreed to record a version of this song for Monty Python's recent live shows. In the comments section on my website today, Marta, who's a regular in the comments section, posted this video, and it just made me think of how much I like the song. And Stephen Hawking, as I said, actually agreed to record a version of this song for Monty Python's recent live show. So it's the song with his electronic voice doing the lyrics over the top. The song is, I think it's beautiful. I love the song. And it's all about how we should remember that in the context of everything, the universe that we live in this massive existence, our problems are actually rather small and insignificant, and that we should realize that many limitations that we feel inside ourselves are actually imposed on us by ourselves, and that the universe itself has no frontiers, and so there should be no frontiers to human imagination and achievement and things like that. And also, it's a nice song about the universe and things, and I'm going to try to do it for you now with very little preparation. Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious or daft, and you feel like you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving, revolving at 900 miles an hour, orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day, in an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side by side, side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round and round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth. All right, then. That's the end of this episode, all about Professor Stephen Hawking. Thank you so much for listening. And I'll speak to you again on the podcast soon. But for now, goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.